Dr. Maple Go, and welcome to Dr. Not Otherwise Specified, also known as Dr. NOS. This podcast is to provide guidance for our junior doctors to navigate medical and non-medical careers. I hope all the doctors out there can get something out of this, whether they're specified or not. Kia pai tora.
Haramai to another episode of Dr. NOS. Today we have Dr. Simon McDowell, who lives in Wellington with his wife and three children. He loves spending time with his kids, who are 13, 9, and 3 respectively, and getting outside and running awesome trails that Wellington has. Simon is a subspecialist in reproductive endocrinology and infertility, and also completed an Australasian gynecological endoscopy and surgery fellowship in advanced laparoscopic surgery. He works both in public and private, and is passionate about doing the best job he can for his patients. Thank you so much for joining me today, Simon. Kia te pehi a koe.
Kia ora. Thank you for having me and inviting me on. Yeah, no, it's good to be here.
Kia ora. Ko titarangi i mangoa te mangoa, ko te aitanga hoiti te iwi, ko Ngāti Konihi te hapu, o ko whangarā te marae, ko Simon tōko ingoa.
Kia ora, Simon. Thank you so much for coming on board. So I'd love to hear the beginning of your journey and why you picked medicine and how you got into medicine in the first place.
Sure. Okay. So I grew up in Hamilton, so in the Waikato. My dad was a vet. So my mum was medical laboratory. She worked with animal embryology and that kind of stuff. And I guess I was always drawn towards the medical side of things. That was just where our family leaned to. I'm the youngest of three. So I love Hamilton, but I was keen to get out of Hamilton, and the furthest place I could find from Hamilton within New Zealand was Otago. So I was keen to go to Otago, and I guess that was my first decision, was wanted to go to Otago and get away from Hamilton. And then I decided I'd try for medicine and see if I could do that. I was always wanting to be a vet like my dad, but he did too much bloody after hours, so I decided I'd do medicine, and then I ended up doing obstetrics and gynecology, which just shows, you know, big an idiot I am, I suppose, because I do a hell of a lot more drugs than Ted probably did. Yeah, but I think that was my journey. And the first year of science, got into med school and went from there, and did the latter half of my clinical years in Wellington, and I really loved Wellington, and I think quite early on decided that I could see myself staying in Wellington long term. Yeah, spent a bit of time overseas, I did my first year heart surgeon year in Wellington and Masterton, and then went to Melbourne for a year, worked at Southern House at Monash, then went to England for a year. I think my year was the last year where we could get direct GMC registration in the UK. On our training intern year, we were all feverishly trying to do English exams and stuff so we could get GMC registration. And so I worked a year in England and just locumed and travelled around, and my girlfriend then, wife now, we bought a van and drove around Europe and we're at the crossroads of staying in England to try and specialise, which never really considered. And so came home and then started down a specialty pathway, and I think I just decided probably reasonably early I was quite keen on O&G, a good 2 or 3 years of just doing a whole bunch of stuff, which was really cool.
That caravan trip sounds amazing. Oh my goodness.
Yeah, it was cool. It was cool. My parents, they did one where they drove from Johannesburg to London and then from London to India. So kind of drove around Europe for 3 months, and it didn't really seem like much of a big deal compared to that. But that was really cool. Yeah, it was really cool. We bought a van, we cut it out. Yeah, it was awesome. Went all the way down to Sicily and over to, where do we go, to Croatia and right up into the northern part of Germany and stuff. It was Poland, and it was cool. It was really cool. It was seems, you know, like a very intangible thing to do nowadays.
I know. You know,
the last 18 months anyway.
Wow, that's crazy. When I know there's quite a few people wanting to do such a thing, but out of curiosity, how much would you advise we budget for a trip like that?
Oh man, I came home with money from, I would just spend it all and have an awesome trip. I remember being at the Vatican, and we were too cheap to go on the tour, and they were quietly, you know, sort of tag along the tour to try and listen to the guide,
And then we came back with, we thought, oh, it'd be good to have some money to buy a house. And when we got home, I must admit, we were both like, oh, this is great having money, but it would have been cool just to spend it. So I don't know, budget. Oh man, I've got, it was 20 years ago I did that. Well, I have no idea. We just went and worked really hard, banked money, and then just went away and tried to keep an eye on it. I don't know. It's
hard,
it's
always to tell. Easy. Yeah.
Always, you know, we were traveling on the English quint, which at that stage, the New Zealand dollar was pretty crap. It was a hell of an easy way to do it. If you're traveling on the New Zealand dollar, I don't know, it's just a lot harder. You really have to budget. Whereas we were living and working in the UK was awesome. You know, it was great. I loved working in the UK. It was a tough and a really cool place to work at the same time.
Wow. I'm curious to know what drew you to obstetrics and gynecology in the first place, because it sounds like you were debating it for a couple of years and then really...
Oh, yeah. No, I wasn't. I knew pretty early on, but I didn't want to... I wanted to do a bunch of stuff. I was just interested in medicine and it was just quite cool doing lots of stuff and getting a bit of diversity. And I think house surgeon years are pretty amazing. You can go and do lots of different things, and even though you'll probably never do it again. But I think I worked in ICU, I did orthopedics, geriatrics and medical runs and a wee bit of, and I think they're all helpful in the long run, even if you just know how the other specialties work. Yeah, YONG. I think it's always a hard one, really. I think I ruled out a lot of stuff. Like I knew I didn't want to do psych. Not that I have anything against it. I just knew it wasn't for me. I was quite keen to be specialist rather than a GP and be a sort of know lots about, you know, a little bit of lots about lots of stuff. I wanted to know lots about one thing. Liked that it was, I guess, patients in my age group generally, especially with obstetrics and stuff. And I don't know if that maybe meant I could relate to them better. I'm not really sure. But I guess the main thing was just the diversity of the specialty ONG. There's just so much different stuff you can do in it. You can be purely surgical. You can be purely medical. You could be purely research-based. You could be an obstetrician. You could be a gynecologist. You could be both. There was so much scope for diversity. And I think obstetrics is the really kind of sexy part of it. At least you really, that's probably, I think, why most people probably are attracted to it, because of it's stressful. It's hard work, but it's also intensely rewarding. So I think that was probably what initially attracted me, but then just the diversity of being able to map out your career. Yeah.
What drew you to reproductive endocrinology and fertility?
Yeah, fortuitous circumstances, to be perfectly honest. I worked in the UK. I worked with some gynecologists at Guildford and the Royal Surrey, and I was mad keen on doing gynecology. I knew I wanted to do ONG, and I was absolutely certain I was going to do gynecology, and I was going to do that and then head back to the UK and do a couple of fellowship and then come back to New Zealand. And then I came back to Wellington and I was keen on the gynecology, but I just wasn't probably quite as keen. And then my colleague I work with now, Andrew Murray, he tapped me on the shoulder and said, oh, you should do fertility or REI, and which is called reproductive endocrinology and fertility, and, you know, I think you'd be good at it and that kind of stuff. So I think it was that shoulder tap was just at the right time, really, where I was probably at a bit of a crossroads and I'm quite competitive and I guess I'm driven. I'm not sure. But I think once I made my mind up and realized, oh, actually, that's quite a cool specialty and there's quite a few different things, and it fitted with my what my mum did and what my dad did. And again, just even within REI, there's so much diversity. You can be really medical REI or more surgical. And yeah, so I think I just seemed to, I had a friend's dad years ago, and I asked him why he did anesthetics, and he said, oh, and he couldn't really explain it, but he said it was like putting on a glove, like, and it just fit perfectly, and it was like you'd worn it before. And I guess that this my specialty or substitution a little bit like that.
Wow, that's amazing. I'm curious to hear, because it sounds like there's a real breadth of work even within reproductive endocrinology or REI. Tell me about the cases, what typically your patients are like and what you're dealing with on a day-to-day basis.
Yeah, sure. So it's really small e, capital I. The infertility is certainly the far bigger part of our specialty, far bigger. But so from the fertility perspective, it is couples struggling to conceive, recurrent miscarriage, also complex medical problems. There may be reasons why people can't carry or need to look at surrogacy, or they've got medical conditions which mean they can't get pregnant with their own eggs, or they need donors, and there's a lot of ethical side to it, the interplay of the legal aspects and the ethical aspects in terms of what, you know, we're allowed to do and what requires sort of approval from
an ethical body. What else we do? There's a lot of surgery that goes with REI. Endometriosis can cause, you know, really bad pain that cause infertility. And we also do looking at the uterus and if there's structural problems that might cause issues, and we help deal with that. And then the reproductive endocrinology part of it is a little bit, there's kids when they come into adolescence that are born with, say, Turner syndrome, and then we don't manage Turner syndrome, but we will manage or help manage the fertility side of it and what that means. What else? Oncofertility preservation. So let's say you've got a 22-year-old who gets diagnosed with breast cancer, will be consulted to look at the options regarding preserving fertility before, you know, treatment that may damage the egg supply.
Wow. This is such a wide range of things that you see. It's just fascinating just to hear you rattle off the list of cases and the list of conditions that you typically see. And I'm curious to know, you must see some medical people within the field who come to you as patients or as clients. Are there any differences in fertility or in family planning when it comes to your clients being medical versus non-medical?
Yeah, I suppose I'm just thinking about it on the fly. I think that, you know, age-related fertility is a problem, is a problem across society, people having kids later. I'm sure that's an issue in the medical field as people delay things, but I don't know if I could say that that is a bigger issue at that group. I'd have suspicions, but I don't have any evidence to support that assertion. I think that medical people are just more knowledgeable. You never want to assume knowledge. I think I learned quite early on. I had a medical person I was seeing and started talking about menstrual cycles and ovulation and all this kind of stuff, and realized they were just looking at me blankly, and they hadn't looked at that stuff since medical school. And even then, it was probably a month, and you quickly forgot it because you weren't going to do ONG. So I think I learned very on not to assume, I guess, the health literacy of the medical person in front of me. And just from seeing a cardiothoracic surgeon, they won't assume that I know the complex operations they do or even how to spell them, probably. Yeah, so I think that we do see more medical people now looking at preserving fertility, egg freezing and that kind of stuff. But again, that's not just in the medical specialty, it's all over. I think in general, the medical people obviously had to study and have a higher degree of health literacy than perhaps other areas of the population. And I guess generally people working in the medical field do, you know, get paid reasonably well, and I probably do have more, what's the word, resources as well, which may be very different to other areas that I see.
I get advised this quite a bit from, especially from mentors and I guess female mentors in particular, about preserving fertility, that if you do nothing else, freeze your eggs. Is that something that you would commonly advise to medical people, given that we tend to delay our pregnancy?
Yeah, I don't think I'd ever advise. I would present options. Does that make sense? And I certainly might have an opinion, but I think it's about presenting options. I think that's the way you should approach medicine now, is you've got to give a recommendation. But it's about presenting options, allow patients to make their own informed choice, and medical people are no different. I think that it is, egg freezing is a real useful thing to consider now. Even 10 years ago, when I first came back to New Zealand, you know, the technology around egg freezing still wasn't that great. And if you talked to me 10 years ago, I would probably give a very different slant on my opinion than to what I would now. We're vitrifying eggs now. They're the largest cell in the human body. They can be subject to ice crystal formation. They can get damaged through the freezing process. But some of the overseas clinics, especially this big one in Spain, they really pushed it and got the technology. And I think really in the last probably less than 5 years, just become a much, much bigger thing. And really, frozen egg now is almost on par with a fresh egg, you know. Wow. which is pretty cool. I think that the term I would advise people is to plan for their last child. So let's say you think, oh, I might want to have three kids. Think of the age you are, where you're going to be when you have that last kid. And I'm the youngest of three, and my mum was 30 when she had me, and she said she was the oldest one at Waikato Hospital. She was, you know, the oldest one. They just couldn't believe how old she was. Wow. And certainly my wife was 30 when we had our first. Wow. So it's amazing. If you look at that in one generation, it's totally flipped around, and we've got three kids. So I think that egg freezing. 10 years ago, I've got a 13-year-old daughter. I would, if she was, I don't know, 33 and seeing me, I would have, she's talked about egg freezing, I would have been, well, yeah, I suppose she could do it. Whereas now, if she was 33 and not in a relationship where she's looking at intimately having kids, then I would say, yeah, go for it. So I think a lot of women who freeze eggs won't use those eggs. So you're not freezing them with a view to the you will use them. You're freezing them with a view to having more options than you would have had later age. And certainly you'll see women who, you know, 39, 40, wanting to get pregnant as a single woman, for example, and the wait for a donor is a couple of years. And if they had frozen eggs when they were 32, 33, 34, they would have had a much better chance. So I would advise the medical people to just be aware of the option and seek guidance. I think it's a really good thing.
Is there a particular age in which we need to be starting looking at options? Because I suppose when you bring up like 39 and 40 and just thinking about donation, then it's, oh, that seems like it's too late. What is the kind of age group that we should be seeking advice if we are looking to have our own kid, for example?
Yeah, it's like with everything, there's a normal distribution. You can imagine your standard deviations, and there's people that are going to lose their fertility. And unfortunately, we aren't able to tell really where someone is on that normal distribution. We do an AMH egg reserve test, which is a very useful tool to look at egg reserve. But it's also a pretty useless tool because it doesn't actually predict someone's fertility. And so at AMH, you've got to be a little cautious in its interpretation. You don't want to, you know, if you've got a high AMH means you've got a high egg reserve, you really wouldn't want that woman to think, oh, I'm sweet, I'll just leave it, you know, I'm fine, because it doesn't tell you about the quality of those eggs, and age is the only determinant about quality. And same as if you've got someone who has a, you know, surprisingly low AMH, low egg reserve, but they've never tried to get pregnant, but you actually have no information to say that person is going to have trouble getting pregnant. We have women with really low AMHs that get pregnant at the drop of a hat, and high AMH is where they have trouble. And saying that, it is still a useful test. And I think if you surprisingly had a very low AMH, you know, I think that would be a nudge down the direction of egg freezing early. So while I think it's a good thing to do, it just needs quite a lot of careful interpretation. And that's why certainly with my GP colleagues, I always encourage them. I wouldn't do an AMH personally in the primary care setting. I would do an AMH and refer, because I think it just needs to be, you know, needs a bit of careful counselling. If you tell people to underact, you don't want people to overreact, just to take the information in its true form for what it is. So I think a woman's fertility in general, you know, looking at the middle of the normal distribution, is pretty stable to about 30. It's pretty stable. And then it's a gradual drop to 35, and then it gets steeper and steeper. And certainly once you're 37 and above, it really does start getting quite steep. A way to think about it is we see a lot of couples where their first child, sweet as, got pregnant first month, but they were 34, 35, and then they're trying for their second one, they're 37, 38, and suddenly they're not getting pregnant, you know. And the only things that change is that kind of slippery part of the graph. So I think that the 30 to 35 sort of age group is the time where I think it's, you know, reasonable to start considering egg freezing or looking at that. I think doing it in your 20s, if you've got a reasonable egg reserve, is I think a bit early in my opinion. And, you know, if you found you had a really low AMH in your late 20s, well, yeah, that might be a trigger to egg freeze. But again, you just got to be quite cautious about that. Yeah, so I think that would be the time I'd think about it. But I'd always encourage people just to go and, you know, have a chat with a specialist, really. I think it's money well spent to have a consultation where we just, you know, have a chat and get some information.
Yeah, that's true. That's true. Looking at egg freezing and looking at these options, I hear it's in the ballpark range of like 10 to 20,000 or something like that.
Yeah, I work with Fertility Associates, so I can only speak for us. But for a round of egg freezing is about 10,000, or is 10,000, slightly under 9,800 or something like that. And then what we've got is sort of figures looking at how many eggs do you need to have frozen to have a percentage chance of having a child. So certainly for someone aged 36 and below, they'd need on average 10 eggs to have a 50% chance of having a child.
unfortunately, having 20 eggs doesn't mean you're going to have 100% chance. It's the graph's going to flatten out. We always encourage people to get to at least the 50% mark. If you're going to do it, it would make sense to get to the 50%. But I guess what kind of level of reassurance is really up to the individual. Some people may take one, two sort of to get to that sort of 10 egg mark or whatnot. If you're 37, then really you need 16 eggs to have a 50% chance. So they do, if people do a second round of egg freezing, then it does get slightly discounted for a second and a third. So I can't remember the exact, but I think it goes from 10,000 to 8.5 to 7 or something like that. Yeah, it's going to be on the website. So I think that was a way of just, yeah, especially for those people who only get 2 or 3 eggs with a round of egg freezer. Those people may need to spend $20,000 to get to a decent number. I had a patient recently who had 22 eggs from one cycle. So she's already at a pretty healthy level. Wow. So, and I guess that's the benefit of freezing eggs when you know, it's like a balance somewhere, isn't it? If you're younger, you freeze, the more eggs you get and the better they are. But I guess perhaps a higher chance you'll never use them. And the older you are, the higher the chance we'll use them, but you need more and you'll get less stimulation. Yeah, so as you get older, the amount of eggs you'll retrieve will generally start to diminish. Yeah.
Wow. It really sounds like quite a rigorous process as well. And it sounds like a lot to put yourself through. And how long can you keep your eggs frozen anyway? Is it a decade thing?
Yeah, theoretically, if you keep topping up the liquid nitrogen tank, your great-grandchildren could use those eggs and they'll be just as good. Because they literally are frozen in time. They're frozen like glass. But you can't do that, which is good. I think that is the right thing. You can't, you know, the child needs to have the opportunity to know who their biological parent is. We're looking at donation and stuff. So in New Zealand, we have something called the Heart Act, the Human Assisted Reproduction Treatment Act, and gametes, eggs, sperm, or embryos can be frozen for up to 10 years. People can apply for an extension. So let's say you've got, we talked about that 22-year-old with breast cancer who freezes their eggs. So, hey, she might not be ready to use them at 32. They can apply for an extension, but it just has to be done in advance, and it's got to go through this committee. And the committee is, to be fair, is they, it would have to be very strenuous circumstances for them to turn down that, if that makes sense. So I think you can get extension as long as it's reasonable. If you're 80 and you're still wanting to freeze your sperm or whatever, then yeah, that could become a bit of a problem. Yeah.
Yeah, that's fair. Other than IVF and egg freezing, but you spoke about surrogacy as well. Is that a common thing in New Zealand? How frequently do you see that?
We do quite a bit of it, actually. In New Zealand, has to be a need. So you can't just, you've got to, I don't know, a movie to shoot or something, or you're too busy, you can't get someone to carry a child. There's got to be a medical need. One of the areas we're doing a lot more of, which I think is really cool, is your male same-sex couples. So really it was, and hopefully, and I think Tamaki Coffee is looking at putting some new legislation through Parliament, and hopefully we'll get some easier legislation. There are quite a few hoops to jump through. I think I'm really, you know, proud that New Zealand's, I think, progressive enough that we're, you know, where female same-sex couples, male same-sex couples, people can have a family regardless of their background or sexual orientation, that kind of stuff. And, you know, I hope that we can get the legislation representative of that sentiment. So, no, we do surrogacy for that kind of thing. Women that have had their uterus removed, they've got some medical condition where they can't carry. We may have situations where the women have had recurrent miscarriage or recurrent failure of IVF, and we just really can't figure out what the problem is. And so we're putting good quality embryos back, but they're just not working. And there becomes a point where we might say, look, it may be time to consider using a surrogate. I don't have the figures for you, but it's certainly not uncommon.
And I wonder if it might become more common now that we see more prevalence of same-sex couples coming through and the gay couples coming through who need surrogacy as part of their family planning. So that's really amazing to hear. I want to double back a little bit because I know you work both in public and private. And I'm just curious to know what your week shapes out like. What do you do on a day-to-day basis?
Yeah, okay. So I have a public role. I don't know what the percentage is. I'm probably 70% sort of private, 30% public, something like that. I am on the on-call roster at Wellington Hospital, so I still do general obstetrics and gynecology, but I am stopping obstetrics next year. I'm just at that stage in my life where I need to cut something out. I've been trying to do a bit of everything, and obstetrics is probably the logical thing for me to take out. I love obstetrics. It's really rewarding and pretty amazing, and probably why I got into specialty in the first place, but I think, yeah, hopefully I'm
my skills are better served elsewhere, I hope, maybe. So anyway, I would be on call. We used to be 1 in 10 at Wellington, but now we're 1 in 12. Every third Thursday, I'm on call at the hospital for 24 hours, and then I do every 12th weekend, just Saturday, Sunday, but we split that. I do a public REI clinic on a Friday afternoon and an antenatal clinic the other Friday morning, and I operate at public full-day listing every month. I used to do a little bit more, but I cut back on that. I operate privately every week, probably sort of have a half day list every week pretty much. And then I probably spend half of my time at Fertility Associates consulting, and the rest of the time is between, yeah, various other things. A little bit of private gynecology consulting, just once, really just once a fortnight. And yeah, I do a bit of university teaching, so do work with the University of Otago there, but that's sprinkled around. So yeah, I've found it very difficult to fit everything in. And certainly, yeah, so I think one of my reasons for coming down from the obstetrics is, yeah, probably just to try and make that work a bit better.
Yeah, fair enough, fair enough. I'm curious to know, can you tell us a bit more about the surgeries you do? Because I know you specifically did your fellowship in this. What are the types of laparoscopic surgeries you do?
So I was really lucky in that with subspecialty training, you have to go overseas, or you have to work at 2 units. So in New Zealand, that really means you go overseas more often than not. I don't know, I was really keen to, and my wife was as well. We had young kids. We were really keen to head overseas for a few years. So I was quite keen to do a sort of an REI specialty where it was quite a surgical slant to it. And so I took a role in Brisbane with Professor Nushir Zdani and Michael Wynne Williams and Ben Croom, who were... He was the ex-fellow who had just finished. He's Kiwis from Auckland, actually. And yeah, that was a really cool role. And Anush at that stage, he was part of the team who was setting up the Aegis Fellowship. So I was a little bit of a test case. So I was just really lucky where the 2 years I had in Brisbane, I was just doing REI and complex surgery, and that was really cool. And a lot of assisting, also a lot operating, but it was a cool role. So it was really, I guess what I'm getting at, it was really a fertility slant, if that makes sense. Dave Malloy was another surgeon I worked with over there. So it was slanted away from the sort of pelvic floor stuff. It was more endometriosis, fibroids, tubal pathologies and ovarian pathologies. So, and really only laparoscopic stuff. I think in my 2 years here, 2 years there, we did a handful of open cases. And they were, all the guys I worked with there were amazing. They're fantastic surgeons. I think Michael's up in Auckland now. I think Auckland's very lucky to have him up there.
Yes, yeah.
And it was really cool. So no, endometriosis, a lot of endometriosis and a lot of really bad endometriosis. And it was really cool to help develop, really cool, good techniques, for approach, which I found that was probably the biggest thing I took away from working with those guys, is they had a certain approach to it. And if you approached it, the problem in a systematic and defined way, then you could do the really bad stuff. You approach the simple stuff the same way you approach the bad stuff. It just develops further. Yeah, that was the kind of stuff I did. Yeah, it was really cool.
Wow. And so it sounds like you had, was it 2 years of fellowship or 1 year of fellowship to do that?
So I did 2 years in Brisbane, and then I did my last year in Wellington. So my last year in Wellington, your last year of REI is more exams, and most people are doing quite a bit of work from that stage. They're really finishing research, working. And so I did my fellowship. I just had a couple of things to do when I back in Wellington, and Michael came actually and helped me just finish off my last couple of assessments for the surgical side of things. And the REI was, I was working at public hospital as an ECMO while I was just doing my last year of REI training.
Wow, it sounds absolutely hectic. Even hearing about it, I'm like, oh my goodness, I can't believe how much you guys go through.
It was, I remember my last, I did the written exam for REI, and I had two young kids at that stage. And I think there's nothing better than having young kids to get you studying, because I was a useless studier. I really was. I spent so much time doing really pointless study. Whereas I think when I had kids, I think I finally learned how to study after studying for 15 years or something ridiculous, finally learned how to study for REI. Because if I had an hour, I had to make the most of it. And so when I did my written and I passed that, which was cool. And then I just physically couldn't
study for my oral for the REI, I just struggled. I'd sit down at my desk and I just would be like, I just can't do it. I'm done. It was years. And happily, I think I knew enough anyway. I'd done enough. And so I did study, but I certainly didn't study as I had for other exams. And happily, I passed. All of the juniors coming through, just when you know you've done your last exam, I was done. Never again.
Oh my goodness, yeah. The relief of being totally finished.
Well, I think for your family as well, you forget. Your family goes along that with you. And my kids were young enough. And my Libby remembers me studying and doing a lot of stuff, whereas my middle child, Joel, he doesn't. And my youngest, who's three, he, you know, got a clue. Yeah, Libby remembers. Yeah, she's quite funny. And
how does she recall it? What is her memory of it?
I think she just remembers that Dad was just... He had to study. So in the evenings, he couldn't put to bed. He had to study and stuff. I'd have to ask her, actually. It'd be interesting to see. But you quickly forget that. One thing I'd always say, you when you start out on a specialty training for everyone, you think, oh my God, it's so long. It's going to take so long and these insurmountable exams. You're a consultant or an SMO for a hell of a lot longer than you are a junior doctor. And yeah, I've been an SMO longer than I was a junior doctor by a few years now. So you kind of, yeah, you forget that. You finish your training and your training really just starts. Not trying to put people off. But you don't have to do an exam, which is good.
That's true. How many exams did you sit from beginning to finish? Because I know Obs and Gynae itself has exams too. And then it sounds like you sat extra exams for REI.
Yeah, ology's not too bad. I always think the anaesthetists have it tough. They do crazy exams, the pharmacology one. So I did vote. For general ONG, you have a written and an oral, and there's a research component and a logbook and all that kind of stuff, and in-house assessments, but it's really the written and the oral. And then for REI, we have a written and oral as well, and our own sort of research stuff that we have to do. Yeah, it's the same. I'm an examiner now for REI, which has been really cool. Been doing that for about 5 or 6 years now. So it's quite good writing the exams. That's a lot more fun than sitting them. But it's cool doing that, because I remember doing some exams and just really, especially when you're so subspecialised, we're quite in REI, we're actually quite a small, close community across Australasia. We all get to know each other really well. And so it's probably easier with the REI exams harder to get a really good exam, because there's just a little bit less people. It's been really great to work with people to try and get them as good as possible and as fair as possible. And yeah, no one wants anyone to fail. We also, the fact is, exams give you pressure to get to a certain level of knowledge and expertise. So I think they are here to stay.
Sadly, I think so too. I dream of the day that I might be in your shoes and be sitting in the examiner's seat rather than being examined. But I'm curious to know also, because now that you're well past exams and well into practicing as a consultant, what do you find are the challenges that you face in the specialty now, or the challenges in your cases or your patients?
I think in terms of fertility, the biggest challenge I identified right really early was the same one I have now, which is managing expectations. I think managing expectations for people undergoing fertility treatment is really the key. One of my mentors, Ben Croon, that was something he told me, and it's always just resonated, because I think it's just really hard, and I hope I'm better at it. I think you reach a bit of a point, and I've heard other consultants say this, maybe sort of 5 years after you start as an SMO, where you suddenly just get more work coming to you, if that makes sense. So suddenly, especially in private, you think, oh my gosh, it's, you know, how am I ever going to be doing any work? And you want to, because it's good doing private, it's fun, and the remuneration is good. Suddenly, after sort of 5 years, the work comes to you rather than you having to find it. And so I certainly found that quite a tipping point, where you think, oh gosh, I can't actually do everything. And you reach a certain thing where, I think being on RANSCOG boards, and I'm on the FSANS board, which is Fertility Society, and it's really cool to do those things. And I guess you reach a level where it is the right time. You're a mid-level SMO and or specialist. So I think just the weight of the workload, not just seeing patients, but just everything. I think that's been my biggest challenge. I don't know, you find it hard to say no to things, and you end up saying yes to too much stuff. And then you just don't have time. And I certainly, what I've found
And I've realized in the last few years, I just having time to think. You're too busy. When you've got time, you're just doing clinical work or doing this or doing that. But actually just having one of my friends at the public center said, I just need, you know, a few hours a week to just to sit there and think about the various problems I have to solve. And I guess that's what I find, actually having time during the working week, not at home when you're with your family, just to think about things and your difficult cases and how to manage, help manage a clinic, a fertility clinic, and make that a good clinic and better for patients and staff and stuff. That's the challenge. Yeah, for a mid-level consultant, I think it's time.
I know now that these days you're stepping back from a couple of things, like crossing off obstetrics in the next while. What are your tactics in creating space and in drawing boundaries? What do you do these days to say no?
I don't think I do. Can you tell me? I don't know. I'll Google it. I don't know. I'm learning. You know, I don't think you ever stop learning. And guess what would I tell the SMO myself 10 years ago? What would I tell me? Because that's probably...
Yes.
I would have just said, just don't try and do everything. It's kind of, you can't do everything. And you just have to be ruthless enough to know when it's time to stop doing something. You know, when it's time to give yourself more time. Your kids are only young once as well. And you don't want to lose those times. And my youngest is 3, he's 4 soon. And you're like, shit, we're not going to have any more kids. No, we're not going to, my son will start school in a year and I want to make sure I'm there because, you know, for his first day in school, because I don't think I have with the other two. And you realize you may have missed some of those moments by being really busy. So I would just say to myself, you can't do everything. You need to set a bit of line in the sand somewhere, but also just get involved. It's such a cool job and there's really cool things to do. It's fun being involved with fertility societies and it's good to not just be a clinician and also to help contribute. I like working public and I don't know if I've contributed as much as I would have envisioned, but hopefully I've contributed in some way to making certainly our hospital better. And yeah, all those things are really, really important.
Now that you're taking more time for family, what is work-life balance to you?
The problem is, and I'm sure this is not just a medical problem, is that you create more time and then the vacuum just very quickly fills with other stuff. Yep. I don't think my vacuum I thought I would have is rapidly gone, even though I haven't stopped obstetrics yet. So I think it's just a myth that you cut down, you just change the balance. So the mythical work-life balance, yep, no idea. I'm not sure if it's a real thing. And I guess the way I look at it is you need to have a little bit of time for yourself. And I play sport and run and that's kind of my outlet. I think that it's really easy to take work home with iPhones and you get your emails and stuff. And emails with patients and everything, it's so handy having it on your phone and doing it. But it's also, it's handy in that you can turn up at work at in the morning and you've got 25 emails and it's like, oh gosh, I've got to do some work and I've also got 25 emails to deal to. So you can actually do some of those from home on your phone and all that kind of stuff. So it's really handy, but you're also working when you're not working. And I think I haven't figured that out at all, but it's a constant work in progress. So I certainly don't say to people, I'd never ever use your emails on your phone or anything like that. That's just not feasible if you want to be a busy clinician. It's just not. Well, I don't think it is. If you're wanting to do a mixed practice, private, public, stuff like that. But perhaps the consultants 40 years ago had their home phone and maybe a pager, and their pager probably went off every 5 minutes, but they didn't have a ton of emails turned up to work. But I do remember a guy I worked with, he was an Auckland private obstetrician, and he said that he knew where every payphone was in every dairy that had a payphone, so that he could, when his pager was out, he could go and ring the hospital to see who was in labor and where he needed to be. And oh my gosh, that must have been stressful as well.
You don't know, it's hard to know which is better now. It's the lesser of two evils, isn't it? I think being a GP and obstetrician back then is going to be just as hard as being an obstetrician now. Oh gosh, it's hard to know.
Yeah, I would just never be brave enough to say they had it better or we had it worse. See, that's not
impossible.
Different challenges, different age, and also different, I think, different medicine as well. We've got new technology and
new conditions that we're treating, different cases. Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah, and I think different patient expectations, different, perhaps more
complexity.
Yeah, but also more visualization on how we're communicating with patients and providing good care. There's a bit more over, I think a little bit more oversight, you know, credentialing and all that. Is that a thing in the day? I don't know.
So true. Simon, I just want to take this opportunity to say thank you so much for your time, for your wisdom, for sharing everything REI and sharing about your specialty. I'm really so grateful. So thank you so much, Simon.
No worries. Thanks.
This podcast was made possible by the New Zealand Doctors Residents Association Education Trust. Thank you for listening. Mā te wā.